by Same Same But Black. This is a group of queer conversations with members of our community speaking to their music, literature, and artistic tastes. Conversations from around the mortal and globally, the cutest. Presented by Same Same But Black, and I'm your presenter, Michelle.
My name is Rona Stace. This is my cue list.
Welcome. This is the cue list. A conversation with Rona Stace. Welcome, Rona. Introduce yourself. And we're going to start her cue list with an introduction. And I'm going to hand you over to Rona.
Thank you for that. Well, I've been having to get used to introducing myself a bit lately. So I do kind of have a standard little brief bio. And I tend to describe myself as a veteran police officer, a parent, a poet, an active member of my local Anglican congregation, and I live semi-rurally with 2.5 cats, a goat, and a chicken called Ms. Berry. And I also just happen to be transgender.
I want to know more about the goat out of all of those things.
Most people want to know why 2.5 cats. The goat is called Nibbler. I actually originally grew up on a small Angora goat stud farm, and we used to take goats to what was then Calf Club Day, and my kids ended up going to the same rural school that I went to, and by now it was Ag Day, so the goat farming was long since history, so we found a goat farmer that we could get a couple of little baby boy goats from for the kids to raise and take to Ag Day. One of them sadly passed away, but we still have Nibbler, who's a grown-up goat now. And his name, Nibbler, just came from the fact from the minute we got him, he would just nibble on anything he could reach, literally anything.
So there we have our first cueless goat. Moving along. Shall we go to our first part of the list? And we'll go to films. And this is a really interesting collection of films that Rona's chosen. So we'll start with Sleeping Dogs, but this list includes Mad Max and Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, they're all actually films that I saw when I was very young, when they first came out, more or less. So I would have been about 9. Sleeping Dogs is a New Zealand film that came out at that time. I'm not sure how many parents were inclined to take their children to a film like that, but mine were that kind of parent, which I'm very grateful for, actually. It's a story, it's a dystopian view of New Zealand's future written at the time, where, and the basic plot line is that the government has developed some rather totalitarian behaviours, and there is a resistance movement that comes into being to fight the government, and it's based on the novel Smith's Dream, which I actually subsequently studied in high school, so it kind of ties in. I think there's a tendency, there was possibly a tendency at the time to see it as entirely kind of fanciful. I think people looking back at it now would go, well, that wouldn't even happen. But I think in hindsight, there was a very real risk. When you think about the way governments were behaving in the 70s and 80s, and it's just as well things didn't turn out that way.
Gonna say, with Mad Max, was it a character, the car, or the style that drew you to that film?
The whole thing. So we have a very dear family friend who's a ceramic artist, but also a film buff, and he had in his house a proper little mini movie theatre, and we would go around there with our parents and the kids would all hang out and stuff. And That's when I actually got to see that movie, because I don't think it was on general release here originally. And if it was, it would have been R18 or something. But I somehow have this thing for a kind of post-apocalyptic vibe. You know, I think since very young age and still to this day, I'm acutely aware that civilization is a veneer. It's a kind of rough around the edges in terms of movie making, but it's got a classic kind of central story. And the whole thing about his, I think the whole thing about his daughter, his son and his wife being killed by the biker gang, and that sets him on the path of his crusade. It's kind of really sad, but kind of, I don't know, it was Mel Gibson. I'll cut through the crap, it's Mel Gibson. And he might not be that popular now, but he was certainly very popular with me for a long time.
Good old Mel, the comeback kid.
Lethal Weapon is another favourite of mine.
And then we move on to why Star Wars? I mean, and episode, the original.
First,
what is it in the timeline? It's the sixth film in the...
Oh, God, I don't know. I don't care. It's the first one they made, and it's the only good one. It's the original, and if you went there, you missed it. I think they've remastered it and put effects in it and all the rest of it, but I saw it in the theatre as a nine-year-old. Like you, it was like nothing else we'd ever seen before. I think the only thing comparable that came out at the time was Battlestar Galactica. It's great, again, a great storyline, great protagonists. And this is an entirely different thing from my political or apocalyptic dystopian flavour. This is a future and some heroes and all of that good stuff. Of course, again, they're fighting an evil empire, so maybe there is a theme, I don't know. But it just, you know, as a kid in the 70s, that was it.
Star Wars was knockout. Okay, let's look at the song collection. And we have the wonderful I Am What I Am by Gloria Gaynor and To Who by The Narcos, which was a Netflix series, if that's the one we're actually responding to, and both worth playing very loud, especially as we approach summer.
Yeah. Well, I Am What I Am is an anthem that became my anthem, if you like, when I was transitioning and dealing with all of that. I developed a real love for those great disco-era divas, which was a new thing. I have an awful lot of stuff from them on my playlist, which is otherwise very, very eclectic. Just that message right through the song, you know, here I am, take it or leave it. I found that very uplifting a lot of times when I needed that positive reinforcement. Plus it's just a banger.
So we're going to say that I Am What I Am is an anthem song and helps disco therapy.
Yeah.
I second it.
Yeah.
And so...
Disco's good for the soul.
Disco's a cure-all. And Tayo, what made that one pop out?
Well, that's actually... that's my alarm clock song every morning. I watched the Netflix series Narcos, the first one with Pablo Pascal, and I was entranced by that whole thing. I haven't bothered watching any of the other Narcos series. To me, that was the one. I'm a bit like that. I watched West Side. I'd never watched Outrageous Fortune, but after Rita went to prison, I never watched the show again because it had just had such a emotional, there'd been an emotional journey there that needed to stop, and that was there and done, and I moved on. And it's just such a cool little tune. And again, it, you know, to wake up every morning to that, it just puts me in that sultry Colombian vibe space. Sets me up for the day.
Narcos. So I recommend everybody watch season 1 of Narcos. So moving on to the next selection, which is intriguing. I found intriguing and also on multiple layers. So your selection of books, you chose the Bible, How to Invent Everything and the Misfortune. That's very eclectic, but also very deep. I'm going to let you lead because everybody will have a question regarding why you chose the Bible, but speak to us on that part.
Right. Well, I think the Bible is probably one of the most misunderstood books ever, including by most of the people who like to quote it. First of all, technically, it's not a book. It's a collection of books. And, I don't hold that it's a book by God. It's clearly written by a book of various authors for which God has very craftily managed to take credit and convince people that it's all about him, her, they, whatever God is. Whereas in actual fact, I see it as a book about people and the dumb stuff people do, in which God makes an occasional cameo appearance, is most often referred to obliquely, and in probably the greatest act of nepotism in the whole of publishing history, dedicates the second half to his own son. So how could you not love it? It's just a great read apart from anything else. I just find it fascinating. I love the story of Job and God and the devil sitting around betting whether or not Job's faith will hold up. I mean, if you look at it, it's so human, really, at the end of the day. And that's the way I read it. I feel sorry for people who don't understand it. A lot of very clever people. There's people like Stephen Fry and some other intellectuals who have an issue with how Christians are supposed to know what to believe when the Bible, on the one hand, is telling them to kill people for wearing tassels on their coat, and on the other hand, telling them to love everyone. Well, if you're a Christian, you follow the New Testament. You do what Jesus said. It was an update. It was an upgrade. This is Bible 2.0, not Bible 1.0. And that's really the way I approach it, and the way I approach my faith is it has to be about, you know, people and your relationship to people, and Jesus was pretty blimmin' clear on how he wanted us to do that. So I don't think there's a lot of confusion. The rest's just backstory, really. Yeah, sorry, I might have offended a few people. But that's just my view. That's just my opinion. Yeah.
I think everybody's entitled to have their feeling and, take time to understand someone's point of view before you come at people. That's my statement for this podcast. And now moving to the other two books, if you want to expand on those, especially How to Invent Everything. I found that quite an intriguing title and book.
So I've always been probably part of the fascination with the potential for civilization to collapse, but also having spent a bit of time doing things like Boy Scouts and roaming around in the bush as a kid and all of that sort of stuff, fascinated with survival knowledge and techniques. So I read a few survival handbooks and things in the past, and because I feel fairly comfortable in those sorts of environments where you're away from civilization. I've done Outward Bound as well, and a few other things. And then I discovered this book, which is How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Traveller by Ryan North. And it's I love knowledge. I mean, I'm interested in everything and how everything works. And really the book is a description of all the things that are required to have a civilization, and then how you might start with what technologies you'd need to develop first in order to develop others. But the premise is that it's a survival manual from a time-travelling machine, so that if your time-travelling machine breaks down, not only will you be able to survive in whatever era of the past you've ended up, but you'll be able to recreate civilization. And so it ticks all the boxes for me, really. It's both, what would we do if we didn't have civilization, but also it's just so much knowledge about how how stuff works, and if you had to recreate it from scratch, what you'd do. I just found it utterly fascinating.
Last but not least, we have Misfortune by Wesley Stace. Expand. Because you say in your piece, and you will see this in the bio, that there is a connection.
Yeah, so a friend of mine, was it a friend of mine or my mum or someone, found this book amongst others when I was going through a little bit of a Dickens phase recently, and thought I'd quite like it, and I had a read of it and I absolutely loved it. It's by Wesley Stace, who's also known as the musician John Wesley Harding. Given where he's from in the UK and what I know of my own whakapapa, there's sufficient likelihood we're connected by grandparents somewhere in the dark, distant past that I've just gone ahead and claimed him as my cousin anyway. And we've communicated by email and Twitter and whatnot. I contacted him to tell him how much I love the book. Basically, it's the story of an orphaned baby who is adopted by a member of the aristocracy who needs an heir but wants a daughter, and so regards the fact the abandoned baby is a boy, the child is raised as a daughter with no, completely isolated from the reality of world on the estate and everything. And then things, you know, all start to fall apart as usual, Dickensian things, the relatives who are trying to seize the inheritance and God knows what else. Interestingly, he admitted he intended starting out to write it as a bit of a period farce, but it actually turned into quite a serious book. And my feedback to him was that although the story is actually quite different from mine, it is by far and away the best portrait of the psychology of gender dysphoria. And I found it hugely relatable on that basis. And on top of which, it's actually just a really ripping good read. And he's written a few other books, and I've gone and got those and read them too, and his work's really great. It's, if you want to go on a roller coaster ride, read any of Wesley Stace's books.
So we're going to just move on to artists, and that is quite a vast collection of people, because we start with what is considered one of the masters, with Van Gogh, or Van Gogh, depending on your pronunciation. What is the connection, and why were they your choice?
Well, I think Van Gogh is a fascinating story in his own right. Unrecognised until after his death. Crate loads of his paintings apparently destroyed by people that he'd stored them with. He didn't think they were worth anything, etc. But I like sunflowers, and I know they plant sunflowers to absorb radiation. So going back to the kind of idea that when you explained the Q-list thing to me, that was kind of like desert island discs, I figured if that desert island was Bikini Atoll, some sunflowers would probably be quite handy to absorb that. That was very facetious of me, though. The reality is that that sort of era of painters through the Impressionists, Post-Impressionists, etc. I really just always enjoyed that use of colour, and there's something about was I heard somewhere that there was a theory that maybe his vision of the world that came through in his paintings was a result of his suffering from migraines. Again, I suffer from migraines, and I get that weird corona thing around my vision and stuff, and I can kind of see that. So I don't know, it just kind of, out of all of them, the Monets and the Manets and so forth, and Picasso and everyone else, I like all their work, but I just picked him. I think he deserved a mention.
The other two artists that we've selected, why, other than the expression that you put in the text, because she's alive, I like that one.
Well, the other two I've picked are dead, so I picked one and I thought I'd better have one that's still alive.
Well, I love that, but can we speak to the selection of why we chose those two artists?
Ricky Brightwell is a friend of mine who I met through work when I started doing work in the LGBT plus space. I think she's a brilliant artist. She's a New Zealand artist, a Māori and Tahitian descent. And she's going from strength to strength, I think. But I just love all her work. She's based in Wellington for the most part. Her latest thing, apart from the graphic artwork that she does, she's been doing a lot of big murals around the place lately. But she combines sort of modern art with Māori mythology, and it's just really striking, bold stuff. She's also now set up a reggae, old school reggae sound system, and goes DJing. And she's come up a couple of times, and I had the pleasure of accompanying her while we went record shopping for old vinyl for her collection. And I think she's cool.
Then we have a last but not least, Hunden Fassa.
Everyone knows him as Hunden Fassa. Oh. Everyone knows he designed the toilets.
Okay, so Hunden Fassa. So we're the last person that we're going to talk to in the artist collection is Hunden Fassa.
Yeah. So everyone in New Zealand knows him for designing the wonderful toilets in Kawakawa. Among other things, he originated in Europe but came and settled in New Zealand. And they've recently opened the Hunden Fassa Centre in Whangarei. I was up there for work for about a week end of last year, and I didn't get to go and check out the new centre. So I travelled up to Whangarei for work again just recently and made sure I took the opportunity to go and check it out and enjoyed it very much. Apart from that, again, childhood influence. We had pictures of his, or you know, prints on the wall at home, and a little book of his artwork, and it just has that same kind of magical quality. And his approach to architecture, I really like. I think that part of that might be that, you know, being the child of an architect as well. So I grew up with his art and a lot of other, you know, more imaginative approaches to spaces and architecture and things like that. And so that's just sort of buried there in my psyche, I think. Plus, one of his things was sustainable living. So again, I thought if I was stuck on a desert island, he'd be good to sort out the toilets. There's a display in the thing of his composting toilet system that he had in his house there, which is also being preserved as a kind of, you know, model for sustainable living, because that's how he treated it, as I understand it. And it's basically from the toilet, it goes through a series of filtering fields that are where the waste is filtered by plants. So it goes through sand beds with reeds and plants and things. I didn't really get to have a very close look at it because there was some old geezer monopolising the time of the poor young tour guide who couldn't get away at the time. I thought that was an interesting job to get stuck talking to people about poos and wees in an art gallery. It was a bit of a surreal experience, but
it's a circle of life.
Yeah, but I'm interested in that sort of thing, that especially living rurally, in future when I move on from where I am at the moment, I would quite like to, you know, explore just doing a few things a little bit differently, so long as they work. But I think he had a system that worked. Yeah.
Okay, and then we move to your three media pieces.
Well, there's two very strong themes there. One is they're all comedians.
Yeah.
Two is they're all dead.
Okay. If we're looking for continuity then. With the three pieces, we have the complete works of Sean Locke, John Clark, and Ewan Gilmore.
Yeah. So three comedians. As I said, unfortunately, they've all passed. So this is all we're going to get from them. So I thought it would be nice to have a complete works. They all make me laugh. They are, to me, they are all so funny. tragic losses, actually, all. Sean Locke died recently. There's a huge outpouring of love for him from other comedians, apart from anything else. Just something about his sense of humour just always left me rolling around in fits of laughter. John Clarke is a New Zealand comedian. We lost him, first of all, to Australia because there really wasn't, you know, recognition or the opportunity for work for him here in Aotearoa. And I think he did some of his best stuff in Australia. I don't care. The Aussies might have got him off us, but we've still got the great stuff he produced. And again, I grew up with John Clarke. Fred Dagg was, you know, childhood influence. I always love to, when somebody corrects me on something, I love to say, yeah, been to Varsity, have you? Because that was a line from one of his sketches. And I like to explain alternative energy sources to people, and when we get onto that discussion, to suggest that maybe we just hook everything up to the tractor because you can run anything off a tractor, which is another one of his classics. So, and Ewan Gilmore, the ultimate Westie, and again much loved. And the irony about his career, and I read a few people say this, was that he never really made it big overseas because his comedy was so uniquely Aotearoa. So, and I think that's actually a great thing. He's, you know, he was one of those comedians who wouldn't have a prepared act. He would just go on and have a conversation with the audience and you'd all be in stitches. Just really good-natured stuff, you know. And, yeah, I miss all three of them.
Wrap up question for the Q list, and the conversations we have are important. And
straight off, well, first of all, yes, I think they're important. I think people are interested in how other people exist and what they think, and that's a good thing. More often than not, what you find behind the public person is actually not what you'd expect, and adds to that appreciation of how diverse and interesting human beings are, and, you know, can lead you to sort of treat people a bit differently when you're aware that there is a whole person behind this person you're dealing with. So, yeah, I think these sorts of conversations are very useful. A lot of people would probably be fascinated to discover my interests as a veteran police officer, because we're one group that people do have a lot of preconceptions about. But the other one, of course, is I'm also transgender. So, you know, there are two groups probably that we could all benefit from understanding a little better. And I'm in both of them.
Thank you, Rona, for taking the time to do the cue list this afternoon, and for my faux pas, which I will be totally out about. And this will remain in the final cut. And thank you for taking the time. And that was Rona's cue list.
Thank you very much for having me. This is just one of those wonderful little life accidents we were talking about before. You know, we come from paths where we never would have crossed, but we both turned up at the wonderful Rainbow Westies event in West Auckland recently. And here we are.
It's magical.
It's magical.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Thank you for taking the time to have this conversation and talking to us about your cue list. Thank you for listening to The Cue List. It can be found on www.samesamebutblack.co.nz, IG, Facebook, and all other social media platforms.